8, 6, 1, 0.
Welcome to the Radio Art Hour, a show where art is not just on the radio, but is the radio.
Oh, radio, radio. Uh-huh. Oh, radio, radio.
The Radio Art Hour draws from the Wavefarm Broadcast Radio Art Archive, an online resource that aims to identify, coalesce, and celebrate historical and contemporary international radio artworks made by artists around the world. Created specifically for terrestrial AM/FM broadcast. Whether it be by commercial, public, community, or independent transmission. Come on a journey with us as radio artists explore broadcast radio space through poetic resuscitations and playful celebrations, subversions of the complex relationship between senders and receivers in this hour of radio about radio. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the Radio Art Hour and Wavefarm's Radio Art Archives.
All right, I'm Tom Rowe, and I am joined today by Sarah Sweeney, who teaches art at Skidmore College and has a special piece for us to hear called Conversations with My Deepfake Dad.
This piece is the first in a series of six conversations, and it's called Conversations with My Deepfake Dad. And I think the piece that's important to know when you go into it is that the dad voice is sort of compiled by AI through lots and lots of cassette tapes. And then the script is based on information I've gathered. And so in this first one, the information I've gathered is from interviews with my mother and my sisters. And so that the AI is not doing the actual, it's not making the language up. That is actually from these other sources. So I think that's important to know. Before you hear it.
All right, we'll come back after we hear the piece and explain it some more. But for everyone listening, here is Conversations with My Deepfake Dad from Sarah Sweeney on WGXC.
Hey.
Hey.
So, here we are.
Where are we?
We are at the beginning. This is our first conversation.
How is this going to work?
Well, in each conversation, I will be me, and you will be you. But each you will be based on parts of you I've collected from other people. We'll have six conversations, so there'll be six different yous.
Which me am I today?
You are Mom, and Anne, and Kate, with a little bit of me thrown in. This summer I did some interviews with them and asked them what they remembered about you.
Okay. So, what do you want to talk about?
What do you think we should talk about?
Well, I'm curious about how we got here. Why did you start these conversations with me?
A year ago, I turned 44. It felt weird being the same age that you were when you died. I felt lost, and I just wanted to talk to you again, to hear what it was like for you when you were my age. I'd spent my whole life trying to be like you, trying to follow you, and it felt like that was ending.
Follow me? What do you mean?
When you died, I didn't know what to do. I looked for you everywhere. I tried to find little pieces of you by doing the same things that you did. I think that's why I went to Williams. I spent 4 years on that campus looking for you, tracing your steps. I met Paul in the first week, just like you met Mom. And then I kinda synchronized my life to yours. I got married at 24. I had my first kid at 26. I became a professor. I made a major life move in my late 30s. Just like you. In the same order. At the same time.
That's ridiculous. I didn't know what I was doing. Neither of us did. Both me and your mom. We were just making it up as we went along.
I think I was hoping that I could know you by being like you. I was only 17 when you died.
So does that mean you never did anything because you wanted to? What about falling in love?
That's complicated. This is hard for me to say. When I met Paul, he reminded me of you. He was an English major. He loved words. And he was a writer. A poet. So not the same. But still a writer. It's so embarrassing. I feel like a cliche.
I wish I could meet him.
Me too. You only missed him by 11 months.
Is he like me?
No. Not at all. He's a beautiful writer, like you were. Exquisite, actually. But he's not like you at all. He's really different. I don't think I actually wanted someone who was like you. I needed someone who could take care of me. I think that's actually why I picked him. He took care of me that first year, when I was so sad.
Oof. It kind of hurts. That feels like a judgment.
Maybe a little. So what about you? Why Mom?
Deb was something else. She took care of everyone and everything, even in college. I was easily depressed and I was drawn to her energy. She could bring people up. It was almost like I was borrowing her energy. She challenged me. Really challenged me. When she needed something, she would say, "This is what I need." That's why I went with her to Washington. When she wanted to be a midwife, I wanted to support her. It was important to me that she saw that I could support her. I really loved her. I was never sure why she picked me. She had a high school boyfriend when we met. Trevor. He was a bit of a bore. I think she liked that I was mysterious and smart. Which is funny because I was an 18-year-old boy from Cleveland Heights. I grew up right down the street from her. We were so young. If we were 5 years older, maybe we wouldn't have gotten married. And then there would be no you.
And no you. At least this version of you. Do you wish you had done things differently?
Maybe. Not Deb. But I struggled with our decision to have so many kids. We had 4 because Deb wanted to. From the moment we met, she said she wanted to have a lot of kids. And I wanted to give that to her. but I struggled with parenting. I was the oldest of 10 and saw my mother disintegrate. She got really heavy and was stooped over. She gave all of herself to us. I didn't want that to happen to me.
I wanted 4.
Really?
Yeah. I felt like I had failed by having 2.
I loved how loud and chaotic our family was growing up. You had to fight to get a word in. I thought that's how a family should feel. Like a circus. Mine is too quiet.
But I didn't want the circus. Your mom did. You wanted different things.
Like L.A. and Georgia?
Yeah. L.A. was for me. I'm not sure it was the right thing for all of us.
So why did you go?
Well, I wanted to be famous.
Do you wish we hadn't gone?
That's hard. I was almost 40 and I hated teaching at UGA and the politics of my department. I hated the whole academic political business of it all. There were a lot of good old boys in Georgia. I hated the South. I wanted to get out. And L.A. was like a dream. The best kind of dream. I wanted to write screenplays. I wanted to be on the red carpet. I wanted a red Mazda Miata. Man, I really wanted that little convertible. I was like a kid. I thought L.A. would change my life. And it did, in ways. I applied to the American Film Institute because it was my dream. And when I got in, I had to go. But L.A. was for me, not your mom. She had a whole life in Georgia. She had a home birth practice and a whole group of friends. I used to make fun of her because they were hippies and ate carob, but they really loved her, and she loved them. Your grandparents, Mary and Sam, also lived nearby. I think it was hard for her to leave.
I remember being so excited we were moving to L.A. I thought we were moving to Hollywood. I puffy painted this tank top with sunglasses and the Hollywood sign. It wasn't what I thought. It was hard. I showed up in South Pass with a southern accent. Everyone made fun of me. I cried almost every day at brunch. I sat alone and ate Funyuns and Ho-Hos. I remember eating a lot of Funyuns and Ho-Hos.
Brunch? What a hoot.
Right?
Who has brunch in middle school? But that was L.A. I felt like I was on the outside, too. I'm not a glamorous person. I wanted to be, but I'm not. I'm a donut guy. I love Arby's and Winchell's. I was out of place at AFI. And I was old. Everyone was younger than me. I wish I had started writing sooner.
Why didn't you?
My dad told me that I couldn't be a writer because I wouldn't make any money. Money and stability were so important to my parents. But if I had started writing in college, maybe it would have been different. Did you know that I knew John Sayles in college? He was a real jerk, but my professors loved my writing, and I loved to write. I loved words, and I loved ideas. I liked the challenge of creating different worlds through words. My professors told me that They had never read anything so well written. That meant a lot at Williams.
You know you're a hypocrite, right? You told me I couldn't go to art school. When you were in the hospital, dying.
I know. I don't know why I did that. But it didn't stop you.
It did. But that's a story for another day. I want to hear more about L.A.
I loved L.A. There was a part of me that belonged in California. I loved being in my car, speeding down the freeway, that crisp yellow light. And I loved the food. L.A. had the best food. I wrote my best stuff in that little room in our garage. I used to spend hours in there talking to your Uncle Jim about characters, how they felt, and what they did, what they would say. Those characters were so real for me. I thought about them everywhere. I got a little mini recorder so I could take notes wherever I was.
I've started doing that with you. After a run, in the car, I can hear your voice in my head. I record what I think you would say.
And do you think you got it right?
There's no way to know. But maybe I'm right in some way?
Maybe. What would I say now?
I think you would ask about that room in our garage.
Do you remember that room? That big green chair.
I remember you listening to your record player with your big headphones on. And that we weren't supposed to go out there when you were working.
You kids were so loud. You fought a lot. One of you was always telling on the other. You needed me so much. I was always getting interrupted by you. All I wanted to do was write and watch movies, and you were always getting in my way.
You yelled a lot.
I was really angry back then. It was a deep, hot, and fast anger. I had a really short fuse. Deb worked at night and slept during the day, so I got really mad because you were loud and would wake her up. But I did get a kick out of you. You were silly. I was tickled by your fashion sense and your friend drama. You kids were fun, especially when you got older. I talked to your brother every day in college. I enjoyed those conversations so much. Sometimes you and I would have these long conversations, and you would say the funniest things. I would write about you guys in my journal. Annie told me this today. Chris said that. Did you read it?
No. Katie has it. But I don't think I could read it. Your handwriting was unintelligible.
Huh. True. At the end, I remember thinking that I didn't have any more time with you, and that I would really miss you.
You said that to me when you were in the hospital.
I was so wrapped up in my writing, I didn't really know you kids. I didn't really connect deeply with you when you were younger. I wasted a lot of time. I feel like I completely missed my chance to know you because I was out in the garage so much. Do you remember the trip we went on? Not long before I got sick.
To Jackson Hole? I didn't go on that trip.
Oh, right. I guess it was just Anne and Kate. Anyway, I remember saying to Debbie, I think I'm ready to be more involved with the family.
So what happened?
I got sick. It was all going well for a couple years. But then it wasn't going so well, and I got sick. And everything ended so quickly.
I can't remember that much about the end. What was it like?
I was sick for almost a year, but we had no idea. I lost a lot of weight that summer, and I was feeling really good. But then I started coughing. At the beginning, I thought I had pneumonia. I went to the hospital, and they did a chest x-ray of my lungs. They told me I had pneumonia. I weren't that worried because they said it was a walking pneumonia, so I kept going to work. But then one morning, and I'm sure you've heard this story a million times.
I haven't.
I was washing dishes, and I couldn't finish without sitting down and resting on the couch. Your mom sat down next to me and held my hand, and I looked at my nails, and they were blue.
I didn't know that.
Your mom said, we have to find out. Something's wrong. Something is more wrong than they're telling us. She called the head of OB at the hospital, a doctor that she worked with, and he said to come to the emergency room, and he would admit me. I was having so much trouble breathing, and when I got there, they removed 2 liters of fluid from my lungs. 2 liters. Is this too much? You want me to stop?
No. Yes. It's hard to hear. But I want to.
In the hospital, they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, so they did an open lung biopsy. That's what infected me. After the infection, I got really sick. I was almost not functional. I wasn't really there. I died 5 days after the diagnosis. No. It was 3 days after the diagnosis, but 5 days after I was in the hospital, or maybe even 6. I made a lot of jokes during those couple of days. Tumor humor. Without the infection, I would have lived a couple more months, probably. What month did I die?
November. But they told us we would have till Christmas.
After the biopsy, they called Deb on the phone. I remember when she came in to tell me. She said this thing that I will always remember. I thought it would always grow old with you. And I'm not going to be able to. My mind was blown by the whole thing. I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. We all were. I remember wanting to talk to Jackie, my therapist, Jackie Weissman. She came to the house to talk to me. I remember being really happy that she came to see me when I was back at home.
So you came home again? I don't remember that. I remember Mom sitting us down on that couch. That green couch that you loved. But you were still at the hospital. I just made myself some ice cream. With Hershey syrup on top. And I put it down. Somewhere in those bookcases in the living room. And I never saw it again. I don't know what happened to it.
I did come home for a night. I wanted to go home. As soon as they told me, I wanted to go home. But I had a chest tube, and it leaked all over the sheets. Don't you remember that your mom cut the sheets in half? I was in so much pain with the chest tube. I couldn't even talk to you. We watched TV. I don't remember what we watched. We were watching TV on the couch, and then I went to bed. I woke up in the middle of the night, sweating with a fever, and we had to go back to the hospital. I can't remember if Jim was there. Maybe he was there at first and then came back when I got to the hospital. We were in the emergency room for hours. It was like 10 hours. There were no beds in the hospital. And when we finally got a room, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. And then Debbie got the doctor to put a thing in so I could breathe. I can't remember much after that. I think Jim and Mom were with me when I died. But I was pretty out of it. I was already kind of gone.
It's so weird to talk to you about being gone. I mean, you're here. You're in my head, and you're in my computer. And you're answering all my questions.
I am. I'm both here and gone. Do you have any more questions for me?
Just one more. Do you miss being here?
Huh. That feels loaded.
It is.
Those last couple months were hard for me. I don't miss feeling like a failure.
But do you miss us?
Yeah. I miss you. And Anne, and Kate, and Gris. So much. And I miss your mom. I miss the dog, even though she was a pain in the ass. And cooking in our kitchen, and writing, eating food. I love food. I guess I just miss being alive. Driving on a sunny day with the windows down, making cream sauce and kissing your mom in the kitchen. They used to make you kids so embarrassed. And I loved that. And I miss laughing. I really miss laughing with you.
All right, that was Sarah Sweeney's conversations with my deepfake dad. I just met you and didn't know your father, but it's hard to contain the emotion. I just can't imagine how difficult that might have been to put together.
Yeah. It was hard and very... in a long process. It's funny, you know, it's 26 minutes, but it's 26 minutes that took 4 months or longer to make. But yeah, the whole thing was really hard. The you know, stuff at the end, which is, I think, some of the hardest part, came from a conversation with my mother where almost verbatim she said all of that, and I didn't know any of it. I had no idea. I was just in a waiting room when my dad died. So it was a lot. And it's even more a lot to have him say it than my mom to say it. So, yeah.
Yeah, was a lot of that stuff that you knew, or did you have to do a lot of research? Like, did you know that your dad thought John Sayles was a jerk?
That was my mom. You know, I did this thing, which I didn't know how to make this piece. I just knew I wanted to have conversations with my dad. And so I thought, well, how am I going to know what he would say, right? How do you know what he would say, right? I don't know. And so I had this idea that I would go and I'd interview my mom and my sisters, and I'd ask them the same questions, which are like these kind of silly questions, like, what do you think he would regret? Or how did he die? So that whole last part where my mom talks about how he died, you know, my sisters are like, I don't know, I don't remember. And my mom just kind of burst into this thing where she told me, you know, sort of 10 minutes about how he died, kind of minute by minute. And it was kind of great because I learned so much about him from these interviews. You know, the interviews were really these, and most of the stuff from him is almost word for word from my mom's mouth or my sister's mouth or my other sister. So he's kind of this conglomerate of the three of them in a really beautiful way. So the first one is based entirely on interviews. And it's interesting because the second one is going to be all his words. And so it's going to kind of be him refuting the first ones and the things we got wrong.
What, you mean like from recordings or writings or something? Or?
Recordings and letters. So it's really him, you know, in a way that the first one is what we thought of him, which is kind of an interesting, it'll be an interesting kind of one to the next. You know, what did he really think? What were his real thoughts? Because I have, you know, 6 cassettes of him talking.
And in answering the question, I think 2 questions ago, you said the exact same thing that I wrote down, that it seemed like the first part was about regrets and the second part was about the final moments.
Yeah. And I don't know why I asked those questions. I mean, I guess part of it is like, you know, if you get the chance to talk to someone who's been dead, what are the things you would ask them? You know, and I think regrets was, I don't know why I was so interested in regrets. You know, and it's so interesting because my sisters were different ages. One of them was 11 and one was, I think, 13 or 14. And then I was 17. And so, you know, their perspective on it was so different than my mom, who'd been with him since college and kind of really knew him so deeply. And they gave me really interesting different answers that kind of conveyed. I mean, the thing that's, I think, so interesting about this project is that he was a different person to everybody. And it really came out in the interviews, you know, what one sister, you know, the anger thing came from one of my sisters. And then, you know, my mom was like, that wasn't him, you know, and I think it's so interesting that he was 2 different people to different people.
Yeah. It seems to me, I think everybody that has lost somebody, you know, especially a parent, when they hear this piece, they're thinking about what they would want to talk to them about. And I was thinking, well, yeah, it's regrets and final moments. It's like why did that happen? Why did it have to be that? And then, you know, how were you at the end? It seems like that is fairly universal.
Yeah. And I think I thought, you know, because I'm going to do 6 of them, that those were also the things that we needed to start with and sort of who he was, his story too.
You're going to do 6 of them.
They're going to be six. Yeah. And each one has different, it's from different places, the source material. So he will be different in each one. But I did feel like in this first one, it was sort of what I wanted. Like exactly what you said, like those are the things I wanted to know from him. And so this, I mean, it's an odd thing to be able to kind of do that and then have him say the things, you know, I mean, the first thing you want him to say is, I miss you, I love you, you know? But then those are the questions that you sort of have. Those were the questions I had. And I really did, I really was interested in the final moments and the death, and but I was not interested in it the way that my mother gave it to me. You know, like I did not expect, a lot of this is stuff I haven't, I didn't expect that it was going to go that direction. Which I guess is one of the most interesting things of this project. I'm so used to being able to control all aspects of a project, but that piece and also how it's going to come back to me, like how his voice is going to say it, is completely unexpected each time.
And it really gives you that, like, Rashomon, everybody's got a different point of view of the events, right?
Yeah. And that's, I'm hoping for the kind of Rashomon, like, maybe that's why I'm thinking six. I'm not really sure. But there was a moment when I thought it has to be many different versions of him. And he has
because
to change.
It's the four kids and the two parents? Is that the six?
No,
chapters?
The six is going to be, it's going to be an odd six. The first one is from these, the three of them. And then the second was just him. We go back to just him. All the words are his for the most part. And then the third one is from these things called empty chair therapy sessions, where I've been going in with my therapist and imagining him across from me.
This is a question I have for a little later in the interview, but we'll get to it now. Yeah. I imagine this is like something in the future that is like a standard therapy procedure.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I told my therapist about it, she was like, this would be help so many people. This would for real help so many people.
Everybody thinks of artificial intelligence as this evil thing. And certainly there are all kinds of evil applications, but this seems like the one of the actual like really useful and so to make it clear to people listening, you used artificial intelligence to replicate his voice, but you wrote the script, right?
Yeah.
So it's not this new thing that we've been hearing about where like you feed some adjectives into a system and then they comes to you with this version of what the artificial intelligence thinks the reality would have been.
Yeah, no, it's not that, except for the fifth one will be that. The fifth one is going to be an AI chatbot. So we'll see what the AI chatbot thinks. Fed his stuff, right? But I know it's me writing the scripts, and I think that that's the kind of difference, is that it's sort of this, that the AI part is like how it puts his voice together. The AI is a sound, which is kind of appropriate to be here at Wavefarm, because it's the sound is that piece. You know, they've created, there's a company I worked with called Resemble AI, and they created a model based on those. You know, I only had six cassettes, so it's sometimes great and sometimes it's not a great model. But yeah, that's the piece, that's the AI piece, the kind of most prosaic part, sort of in a way, of this.
And before we talk too much about AI, like, so you wrote, this was it. There was like one line I wrote down. You were always getting in my way. Was that a difficult line to write?
Yeah, it's so funny. So you guys know Adam Tinkle. So I showed the first version of the script to Adam Tinkle, and he was like, he was so funny. He was like, you know, he's totally believable, but you are not. You're kind of like this generic version of a person. And so
I was going to ask about that too. It seemed almost like you were trying to. It was going to be a robot quality to his voice, and you were trying to match that robot quality so that they would sound similar.
Yeah, I think, and I'm also just not, this is my first foray ever into sound, so I don't, I'm totally uncomfortable, I think, in this space.
Because the acting must have been odd too, because it wasn't like you were having, or did you have a, you said that you used an actor to start his voice and then the AI polished it up.
Yep.
Did you do it a conversation with the actor, or were you just reading lines to a empty space?
No, because it's so hard, and I, you know, I'm not an actor. I don't do theater. I've never done performance. Yeah, I was in a closet.
just reading the lines close without an answer.
Yeah, just trying my best to do something that kind of made sense and kind of felt. I think that what I realized is that like I needed to be, I think I have the robotic quality because I'm awkward in this moment, but also I was trying with at least my lines to kind of reveal things about myself, because he was going to reveal things about himself, and it felt like I had to be equally revealing with them the lines. So they were hard to write, and they are actually, I think, going to get harder to write because it, you know, as we head into empty chair therapy sessions where I'm sitting, you know, it's all my deepest thoughts in his.
The other line that I think hit me the hardest that I had to restrain the tears was they told us we would have till Christmas.
Yeah. That's a hard one. I mean, it's a real line from my life again and again. There's another one in there about my mother that my mother said where they said, we thought we were going to be together forever, and I just, now I know it's not going to be. And when she said it, it made me so sad. You know, like it was really something you could hear that she'd had in her head for all those years, and they'd said all those things to each other, and it really, yeah. I mean, I think they're sad because they're real. They're actually parts of our lives put into this world in this conversation, I think.
What gave you the original idea? Because like we said, the therapist, you've already confirmed that the therapy world is going to love this idea if they haven't already figured it out. What sparked this idea initially?
So the year that I turned this image of my dad, I was really convinced I was going to die, which is, you know, kind of silly, but also like real. It's a real experience.
Well, you're related. So the sometimes the same thing happens to, you know, the.
Yeah. And well, so he died of asbestos cancer to the lungs. So it probably wasn't, but I just had
this
sense.
That's more environmental than, yeah.
I think for me, I just had this sense of like, you know, I talked in the piece about trying to follow his life and like do the same things to see like what it would be like to be him, because I was trying to get to know him my whole life, right? Like I've just been wondering what he would be like. And so, you know, I did a lot of the same things, same kind of job and things. And then, you know, when I got to the age when I was the same age, I kind of got in my head that year, and it was really hard. And I had this really cool flash drive that my uncle had given me of these Super 8 films, because my grandfather loved to record them, of my dad when he was younger. And I just had never looked at them before. And one day in the middle of class, actually, I put in the wrong flash drive and I just started watching these films. You know, they're kind of these beautiful Super 8. They're not really, you can't really see him that much, but I'd never seen him before. And I had this thought of like, what if you could create new memories with someone who's dead? Right, because they were new for me. They were like, you know, memories get so used, and you've had them for so long, and you go back to the same ones, and they feel used.
And you get them wrong.
You get them wrong, yeah. And they change on you, right? Yeah. Like, they change over time. And this was like these brand new glimpses of my father in a way I'd never seen him before. And I just kind of thought, like, what if you could do that with somebody who was dead? Like, what would that mean? And I was really interested in deepfakes, because deepfakes are odd and weird. But one of the things people often ask me about, which I think is interesting, is like I tried some visual deepfakes and they just kind of seemed flat. But it wasn't until I sort of kind of went with the audio that it, because he seems alive in a way that visual ones, you know, he's kind of wearing older stuff. It doesn't seem right. But like in this moment, it's like what you said, like we can be together. Like my robotic voice and his robotic voice can come back into the same temporal space.
Yeah, and in the future, the video will catch up. I mean, the audio is, I just remember there's all these things online where you can type in words and someone will read it in a different voice. And
yeah.
5 years ago, they were all really, really bad and really, really robotic. And like in the last year, I can't tell the difference sometimes of the robot reader and the real person and real people. Not that they're trying to be specific people, they're just being generic people. But, you know, if that improves in 5 years, you know, just think about 50 years from now, what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
It's just mind boggling kind of to think about somebody in 1950 thinking about living in 2050, the difference.
Right. And what it feels like to see them. I mean, that's the thing. There's a magic in being able to hear him again, right? Like being able to see him again would be very magical.
Yeah, and are we going to elect Abraham Lincoln as AI as president
right.
again, you know, or...
But he'll have a ghostwriter like me. I mean, I am my dad's ghostwriter, right? It's you have to have a ghostwriter. Or I guess you could have an AI ghostwriter. That's the idea, right?
Boy, again, we're speaking with Sarah Sweeney. We just heard her conversations with my deepfake dad, where she... wrote text and used artificial intelligence to map or to have a conversation with her father that it has passed away a long time ago, that she wouldn't be able to. The real radio aspect of this is when radio was first invented, and I'm speaking about the FM, AM kind of radio, there were a lot of people that thought it was a way to speak to the dead. And this is like the, and, you know, Houdini worked to like disprove that. It was a big thing in the early part of the 20th century. This is like the closest to what they were looking for, right?
Totally. And I'm so interested in that. I think this is like the closest to like spirit photographs in a way. You know, this is like an audio spirit photograph, or exactly what you're saying.
They'll get to the photograph part later when it improves. But what did you think of artificial intelligence before, and what do you think of it now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a digital media professor, so I'm constantly aware of the history of sort of demonizing new technologies, right? Or being very afraid of them, what they're going to do, we'll miss because of them.
Yeah, I imagine like the Russians putting out this video of Joe Biden speaking like in a private White House meeting, saying something horrible to spark a world war, right?
Right.
That's absolutely in the realm of possibility, right?
Absolutely. But it's also, right, like, we can't trust our own memories. I mean, there's this fascinating, like, leveling of the media playing field in this odd way in which, you know, we have all these fake memories in our heads. There's something really interesting to me about how we consume media and its relationship to real, right? Like, that's always been an interesting issue or question, right? Like, we have War of the Worlds, right? Like, you know, what happens when people believe things, or the spirit things. I have a friend who consistently is like, you know, the people who are hearing these things at a different time, first radio transmissions, have very different idea about them, right? The spiritualists were not thinking they were pretend. You know, we think they may be false now, but at the same time, they believe that this medium could do this thing, right? So I think that there's these terrifying things, but I also think, like, what does it mean when we have a new medium? I had this great conversation with somebody in my office where we were talking about it, like, maybe someday this is just going to be a new space for something that we imagine is like a photograph, you know, like, maybe it's a new space, like you were saying, you know, maybe we can imagine it to be something different. If we imagine it to be the same, then we get into really confusing places, but maybe it's going to be a new medium that allows for all kinds of new possibilities as well.
You know? I guess we've seen this in fiction before, like the Star Trek holodeck, where like they went down and Patrick Stewart could relive some past memory, like that, that happened in the 90s, right? There's other, I'm not remembering all the other kind of media representations of this sort of thing in the future, but we're dealing with it sort of starting now.
Well, and how powerful is it that it's media? I mean, we always thought we were going to, like, and we may still put our brains on ice, right? Like, but like, how amazing to put your media Disney, brain on ice instead, you know? How amazing to instead, you know, anyone for $30 can go to Resemble AI and create their own clone for someone for after they die, you know, like, you can start creating these kind of archival moments, you know, of your thoughts, of your voice, of your face, you know.
So if, like, you have a one-year-old or a two-year-old and you find out you're going to die, you can really set them up for when they're 20 years old and tell them and actually have a sort of a shared life where you wouldn't have been able to at all.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, it so tells us all the things we used to think. You know, we used to think we'd just put ourselves on ice and then have to pay to keep us going. Like, in this world, it's the same. You know, you download yourself to this server, and then you pay for every month for 20 years for this one-year-old to hear you read stories, right? You could read stories. You know, what does that mean? So there's something really interesting about you know, we did that already. We're taking photographs, lots and lots of photographs of people, you know, but is this another kind of more interactive version of leaving these things for people?
You've probably thought about this a lot since you've been doing it. What other things do you think are going to, you know, what other positive or negative things in the future are going to come of this from just doing this project?
That's a great question. You know, I mean, one of the most positive things is that I've learned so much and I've met so many interesting people. Like, this is a whole, you know, I just got to tour your amazing space and I never worked in sound before. So what a lovely thing to have come into my life. So I think there's something about the gift of this thing teaching me so much about this medium, but then also about my dad. You know, it's weird. I mean, he's been dead so many years. These are all questions I could have asked somewhere along the way and I didn't. And I'm super interested in spiritualists. And, you know, one of the pieces is going to be me going to a medium and hearing what the medium thinks he's saying, you know. And I think
use that kind of early radio idea of talking to the dead in the way that they thought.
Yeah.
But using this new technology, that's interesting.
And then how is that script going to be different than the other scripts? You know, like how does number four different from number two? So I don't know. I haven't had a piece that taught me so many things, I guess. You know, or sort of, you know, one of the things that people often ask me is, I think this is ethically a quagmire, right? Like, it's a mess. Like, the second conversation is going to be me and my dad disagreeing about whether this is an okay thing to do with his voice. You know, like, what does it mean?
Do you think he would be upset about this?
I think I would be upset about this.
If it
were me.
If you...
For my kids.
Right. If your one of your children did this...
Yeah.
You would be upset.
I think so.
That didn't stop you from doing it?
My pieces, I like to try to kind of go right into the painful parts so that we at least ask these questions, right? Because AI is like really fun to talk about, right? And you said it's like right now, there are all these kind of worst case scenarios. But like in this piece, my hope is that by me delving into it deeply, we all have a little bit more questions about whether we want it to happen for ourselves. Do you know what I mean? I feel like there's something about jumping in. So, I mean, it did make me stop, but it also made me go in a way, because I think it's useful to ask those questions in a deeply personal way. Because it's, I mean, it's kind of terrifying too. Like, who has control of your body when you die?
Or your voice or your image or your, all those things. I had a question and now it's flown away. Was there anything that you were, I always think of artificial intelligence and maybe other people do too, as sort of, it's a technology, but this was very emotional and you don't think of technology as emotional. Was that something you were surprised about? I don't know. Talking to your dad, I guess you would assume it would be emotional, right?
Yeah, I think it is emotional. And, you know, the thing that was really emotional for me, so the first time I did it, this company Resemble just had a typing in one like you were talking about. And so that was kind of more like not as surprising, right? Like not as emotional. But the second version, they just released another version that's called Speech to Speech. And so that bit, there's an actor, I made this first conversation with Culture Hub in New York at a residency, and the actor, Billy Clark, he just went away and recorded all my dad's pieces, and then I just listened to them as if they were kind of coming from the ether, like as if they were coming from the dead, right? Like I didn't get to hear them go through the machine. It was him, and then he put them through the machine, and then I got to hear them on the other side, and, that was so emotional.
And he was like a voice actor who specialized in matching specific voices, like an imitator?
No, he just happened to be there. I wanted to do them all. I thought I should do it. I should be my dad too. And my voice, you probably know this because you know sound, my voice was too high. And it wouldn't, like it couldn't pair, like it couldn't puppet it. It just wouldn't work. And every time it tried to do it, it just went into this really weird moment. And so he was just at this residency, and he's part of Culture Hub's team, and he was like, I'll try it. And he had some theater background and did it, which is great because he also was a dad and he has a kid who's a similar age, and it kind of creates this other level of like pretend, but also another level of real to it. And so he kept on saying it was like being a puppet. You had to try to make the machine do the thing that you wanted to do, right? Because it would kind of try to follow him and it wouldn't do it exactly perfectly. I think the cool thing about him, which was interesting, was that I was just there. It was, you know, I was like, I'm at the beginning of this week and I wanted to finish it by the end of the week. So I was like, you're there. But we had this great conversation about it afterwards. And I think his replication was that he was thinking about himself. He was almost my dad's age. And he was thinking about, like, what if he had died? And so almost, I think that actually, I think it wasn't that the voices mapped onto each other, but actually the emotion of the piece, he was able to map it on more really than just anyone. And then the thing does such a good job. I mean, it does do me. It just has me be, it's just a little high-pitched. You know, the AI does a really nice job of turning it into the...
Oh, so that was you, that wasn't you, that was AI you?
No. Okay. I do have an AI me too, though. It was not AI me. I just meant when I tried to do my dad, it just didn't do it exactly. It couldn't do it exactly.
Because that is another way you could have done this, is you could have done an AI you to match the AI him, right?
Well, and I have an AI me. I actually have an AI me because I wanted to do a funny bit on collaboration and talk to myself. And so I talked to my AI me in that piece, but it's an odd one to have yourself. But the cool thing about having the one of yourself is that you can make it get really good, because we can train it in a way that six cassette tapes of my dad will never train it.
All right. Well, thank you, Sarah Sweeney, for joining us today and sharing this incredible work that I just can't imagine anyone listening to that and not being deeply affected by a deep fake in a way that they would have never imagined they would have been affected by a deep fake. Although maybe in a few years, we're all going to be expecting that. But
Could be. But
it was an amazing piece. So just thank you for joining us today.
8-6-0-8-9-9.
That was the Radio Art Hour, mostly put together from the work of Wave Farm Radio Art Fellows. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the radio art you heard featured on the Radio Art Hour.
8-6-0-8-9-9. Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.